Hey, gang, when you think of cold open, does being snowed in your parents' house come to mind? Well, such is the state of the union for a certain female political playlister. And to add a bit of absinthe into that already spicy parental cocktail, imagine you're also trying to plan a wedding. Sounds super fun, right? Well, look, leave the sitcom writing to us professionals. But what you can do is nestle up by that blazing fire and hit play on this episode of Political Playlist Happy Hour.
Welcome to Political Playlist.
All right, are you ready, guys?
Happy Hour.
Happy Hour.
You fucked that up so bad. God.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to Political Playlist Happy Hour. You know who the hell we are.
If someone's listening for the first time? We have to be cooperative to be here.
Why don't we just describe ourselves? You know, I have Republican hair.
That's good.
I am aforementioned woman snowed in at her parents' house planning her wedding.
Yeah. How's that going?
You know, it's going okay. Today I was asked to delete the food item from our catering menu of grilled cheeses to be handed out on the dance floor.
No, why?
It's like the worst decision you could make.
That is a huge mistake.
Yeah.
Huge mistake. Why would you do that?
Because we're
not fancy enough
at the after party.
Can I bring a George Foreman grill and just do it sort of freestyle?
Yeah, just put some truffle, make it a truffle grilled cheese.
We can do a DIY grilled cheese station.
Oh my God.
You're not going to eat anyways at your wedding. So,
well, it's not about me. It's about, I will eat at my wedding.
Okay. How cold was it for all of you?
It's been freezing. It has been freezing.
Oh, well, it's 50 degrees in LA. It's freezing.
Yeah. Right now, it was
48 in my bungalow. Okay.
In New York tonight, it's supposed to be like -6. Ooh, is it insane in Denver?
It was -14 weekend in Denver.
Oh. Well, guys, guess where it was also super cold yesterday?
Iowa.
And that is Iowa. We're shucking right into the news here, gang. And the results are in. Donald Trump still controls the Republican Party.
Yeah. Talking no one.
Well, what do we think of this here, gang?
I mean, it's not surprising. I think that what was a little bit annoying is that neither DeSantis nor Haley like stuck out, which would have forced one of them out of the race, which I think would have made for a more interesting and effective primary in the next few elections. I don't know. Like, I think this whole thing, like the overanalyzation of, you know, like my mom loves watching cable news. And so I'm watching a lot of cable news and,
you know,
overanalyzing of the Iowa caucus. I'm sort of like, it just felt, what we all thought was going to happen happened. And if you don't like Trump, this should be a fire under you to do something.
Yeah, I think it's pretty sad. Like, a bunch of people I talked to today, no one's happy.
Yeah.
And it's almost like people don't even care. And a lot of people have already solidified in their minds saying it's Biden and Trump.
Yeah.
And it's, the answers are like, whatever, we'll just see what happens. Like,
well, I think that it's like, I think that that is true. But then I think it's like, if that's the inevitability, I think that what I would encourage people to do is think about, yes, we're not a fan of either of them, maybe, but like, what policies do you care about? You know, like, take the person out of it. Like, what, and this is, whether you're conservative, you're liberal, whatever, like, what policies do you care about? What things do you want to see done? Like, take away the fact that they are who they are for a second. And if you don't like either of them as people, then think about it in a more political sense and like, try to get those policies enacted. Try to get the person who's standing behind those policies elected. I just think that at this point, like, the primaries are going to be,
well, that's a very interesting thing that you say, and I'll kind of maybe counter with a slightly different point of view. First of all, I think it's very dangerous. I think you're absolutely right that everybody
would you like to push back on that a little bit?
I would just sort of nudge back with a couple of thoughts. And, you know, the first thing is that I think it's very dangerous to go into an election this far out with that kind of complacency of like, well, you know, it's a done deal. It's going to be Biden and Trump, you know, because that just totally totally incentivizes low voter turnout. And by the way, statistically, what we saw last night in Iowa, weather notwithstanding, only 14.4% of registered Republicans in Iowa turned out for the election, for the
like 100,000 people, right?
So it was 108,000. It was the lowest caucus in recent years. And the irony there, of course, is that Trump won by the biggest percentage of any caucus there. So, you know, he got 51%. DeSantis got 22.2%. Nikki Haley got 19.1%. So suffice it to say that half the Republican Party is, if we're looking at this snapshot, which I'll caveat in a sec, but half the Republican Party wants Trump, and the other half that wants an alternative hasn't figured out who that is. But I'd say this, though, Anna, to your point about vote looking at policies. Yes, I agree with that if the nominee is anybody but Donald Trump, because I think what is very interesting to see is they did a focus group of Iowa voters who were, or excuse me, of New Hampshire voters who were four different candidates. And when asked, this was sort of on one of the news, this was on CNN last night, when they asked, okay, if your person doesn't win, how are you guys all going to vote? And everyone was like, Republican, no matter who it is. So this idea that, you know, I think there's a lot to say about Trump. We're not going to go into that. But I do think that a lot of people feel like there is a desire for a Trump alternative. But this adherence to party identity, I think, actually gets in the way of political policy implementation.
I don't totally understand what you're saying.
Well, meaning that I think a lot of people, a lot of what's happening is people are just so tribal. And that is not something that is new in the last 4 years. But so what's happening is that all of these people who were this little voter snapshot who want other people who are maybe into DeSantis or maybe into Haley.
Right. That they're saying I'm a Republican.
But they're like, I'm Republican no matter what. And no matter, even if the guy on the ballot is facing 98 felony counts, I'm still voting for him because I'm a Republican. And the reality is that if you actually go back and look at the Donald Trump track record, honestly, it was a rather ineffective track record. And, you know, if
well, I think that depends who you ask. I think if you ask a religious person, they think it was effective because he was able to get Roe v. Wade overturned. And that's all.
That was a big deal. That was absolutely a big deal.
Yeah. And this. Yeah. But the stock market is still bouncing back. And
OK, so where do you guys think Vivek's voters are going to go? Because I was actually surprised
100%.
He got it. So I think. So let's talk about the facts, right?
Yeah.
It's the largest. It's the biggest win in Iowa caucus history by any candidate. Yeah. That's pretty freaking wild.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I have a hot take on Vivek, and I would be very curious. Not that we want to spin conspiracy theories here, but I would not be surprised if something comes out that one of his super PACs was colluding with the Trump campaign. Vivek, this entire time,
ambassadorship
feels like a Trump plant all day long. That this guy, there's something going on here that...
You heard it here first.
Yeah.
I mean, I do feel like Vivek was basically trying to, like, say, I'm like the Trump for Gen Z.
Yes, this was an audition for, some cabinet.
He's like the Mayor Pete of...
Oh, God. Well, you know, here's the thing. I think it's important to put a few things in context and in perspective here. You know, so obviously the lot was made. You were right. The media just wet themselves with discussion about this caucus. But
I did too.
The reality is that Iowa represents, yes, a snapshot of the Republican people, of the Republican voter, but Iowa is mostly white, mostly religious, and mostly rural. And so this is, at the end of the day, a small snapshot of the Republican Party. Is it an indicator? Yes.
But I would like to push back on that.
Okay.
I think that Iowa is quite representative of the Republican Party for the three reasons you just said. They're white, they're religious, and they're rural. And I think that those three demographics make up the majority of the modern day Republican Party. There was an interesting tweet from Josh Hawley, Republican senator from Missouri, where he said this primary has shown that the Republican Party is now the party of the working class, and DC politicians need to get in line and realize that. And I kind of feel like Iowa is in a lot of ways represent, like, maybe they're not representative of, like, maybe you're right, they're not representative of the sort of suburban, you know, moms who are Republican. But I feel like those rural, religious, and white are the three major categories of the Republican Party right now.
Well, specifically evangelical. Let me just amend that's that true. Religious thing. And evangelical is a different thing.
In Iowa, yeah.
In a way. But, you know, I think it's different than South Carolina, and it's vastly different than New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And so I guess my point is that, like, we're talking about 108,000 voters compared to, you know, 80 some odd million that voted for each side in the last mm-hmm. presidential. So it's a pretty small subset. I guess
110,000 people voted.
That's crazy.
110. Oh, yeah. Oh, thousand. Yeah.
Thousand.
Yeah.
Only 110.
Right. I mean that's plus. Like more people live here in Venice. It's kind of wild.
More people live in your back bungalow in Venice.
Yeah. No kidding. It is like, I mean, dictators like Putin and President Xi must like watch this kind of thing and be like, are you guys insane? Like, you let these people decide? Like, it must, our whole thing must like confound every single dictator, but yeah, also like give them a little bit democracy. Of like jealousy.
We have a very odd democracy.
Yeah.
I mean, someone like a Putin has to be cheering right now if he's not already dead. But like he has to be cheering that Trump is looking like he's going to be the next president. And yeah. That, I think, is the scary thing, in my opinion.
Cheering and then deploying his people.
I'll give Trump credit. He pushed back against China. And now a lot of people think China's our worst enemy. Mm-hmm. All these other dictators around the world, though, are just getting their chops right now.
I think in terms of that, it's like China, I think, in the long term is going to be our biggest adversary. But we have some real short term issues with Russia. And
I think Russia's got dirt on Trump. I think they got something.
Interesting. Well,
today's really an episode of conspiracy theories.
Shall we continue with 2020 election news?
Who's got an X for me?
I have an X for you.
Do we have to say that? I feel like we're calling them tweets. They're tweets.
It sounds really dumb. Okay. So this is the tweet. A very normal thing to do at 2 a.m. is tweet your election denying song to the president.
Uh-huh.
That's the tweet.
Oh, man. Your election denying song. Oh, wait. This is a very odd thing to do?
It's kind of sarcastic. Like very normal thing to do at 2 a.m. Right. Your election denying song.
I don't think it swallowed well because we talked about him last week.
So I'm just going to lay some ground. This is someone who is running for a higher office.
Oh.
And he is tweeting this about his most likely opponent in a very competitive state that might determine control of the Senate.
Ooh, okay. I'm going to go.
Andy Kim.
Nope.
Ruben Gallego.
Yes. All right. So I'm going to.
Third time's a charm.
I'm going to.
Excuse me. I didn't get a guess. I didn't get
you
a
didn't
guess.
Get it. Whatever.
I'm going to play something for you guys.
Ooh, we have an audio clip. It's almost like we engineered this.
It's almost like we engineered it. So are you ready to hear this?
Okay.
Here we go.
Great introductory music.
If you had told me 2 years ago, 3 years ago, that I would be in the middle of a political movement, I would have said, go down Hunter's Crent Bible. Right now. Not care for the groceries. Not care to forward your gas. I marry and you feel back better. The middle singer, the middle class.
They've pushed off an already pissed off woman.
I mean, this is incredible for so many reasons.
A little scratchy.
Well, scratchy, sure, fine. So that's a campaign song from Carrie Lake, who is running for Senate on the Republican side, most likely against probably Ruben Gallego. And she famously lost the governorship in the last election of Arizona. She is a huge Trump supporter. That song is basically bashing Joe Biden. And she tweeted a link to it, tagging.
It was catchy. It had a catchy.
It was like a kind of a country song. She tweeted it to Joe Biden at 2 o'clock in the morning. And that's what Ruben was commenting on. But I wanted to kind of talk about this race.
What are you doing, Terry, at 2?
Hey. I think that was the point. But, you know, there's a couple of things that came up when I was looking at this. The first one was that I hate that this is our politics, that someone is making a video with like every bad clip of Joe Biden and also like making fun of Hunter crack addict. I don't love.
Well, and also the person doing that has zero policy legislative experience.
Yeah. So that's the first thing. Don't love that. Sort of more to the electoral side of it. So there's a new poll that came out that shows that Gallego and Carrie Lake are neck and neck in a 2024 Senate matchup.
Wow.
And it's Sinema.
Where's Kuki?
Kuki Kyrsten Sinema has not said if she's running yet or not. If she runs, the polls show that it'll give Gallego more of a boost than Lake, meaning that more Sinema voters who probably lean Democratic because she was a Democrat would go to Gallego than would go. I'm wrong. If Sinema runs, the poll says that Gallego will actually benefit more than Lake, which is very interesting. Huh. So that's the opposite of what I just said, which is it basically means that if Kyrsten Sinema runs, she actually will take more conservative, I won't use the word conservative, I'll use Republican voters from someone like a Carrie Lake, because I think a lot of Republicans will see Sinema as a more moderate option to Carrie Lake, whereas mm-hmm. Gallego is potentially managing to get a wider swath of the Democratic and maybe left-leaning moderates in Arizona. Gallego has actually dropped in the polls since last fall by a little bit. And so what I think is kind of interesting about this is that this race could very well determine who controls the Senate. It's a swing state. There'll hopefully be very high voter turnout in the election. I think Latinos, you know, Ruben Gallego is Latino himself, but we know the Latinos are starting to sort of gravitate more Republican than they ever have before. And so what I've found interesting is that he's dropped in the polls. And I'm curious what you guys think. Like, I kind of feel like it's really been in the last maybe like 6 months, there seems to, and I think it's as the primaries are leading up with Trump, it feels like there's kind of this like swell for Republican politicians who are riding on Trump's coattails a little bit. And I wonder if I kind of feel like someone like Carrie Lake is benefiting from that.
For sure.
You got to take it right now, right? There's obviously another wave of Trump throughout the country that's going to happen. There's going to be tons of congressional people who come out of this. I will not forget some of the midterms where all these people we thought that were going to win did not. So they actually lost considerably. Yep. So the Sinema, though, she hasn't announced if she's running or not. Right? Everyone's just assuming she's not running.
It'll have a big impact on the race. I mean, it seems like even if she does or doesn't, it'll have a positive impact.
So,
but
I think that the vice president nominee for Trump is going to be one of two people. I think it's going to be Carrie Lake or Kristi Noem, governor of Dakota.
I think it's going to be Kristi Noem.
I think it's going to be Sarah Huckabee.
Well, that's how you win.
Yeah.
Yes. But I think that Trump is far too vain.
He wants a pretty lady.
Trump wants a hot younger woman next to him. And his pick is not going to be a guy because he feels threatened by
Melania.
He is going to pick some, you know, very attractive, ready for primetime television woman who is going to be his yes man.
I disagree. I think he wants a bulldog.
I think he wants a bulldog as his chief of staff.
And Sarah Huckabee Sanders, right, just came out talking about a story about North when they met with Kim Jong-un. And I guess Kim Jong-un looked at Sarah Huckabee and like made a smile or something.
Oh, my God.
I think Trump told her, like Trump said something along these lines. Don't take my word for it. But like, we're going to send you over there. And you got to take one for the team, for your country.
Oh, my God.
What?
Yeah.
I think I had heard that. Yeah.
Sarah Huckabee was like a report. Said yeah. that Trump said that.
Like he was joking, but yeah. like.
But that's like. But
it's
she,
locker. It's locker room it's talk, Anna.
Right.
All right.
That,
stop.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
I do remember. Because I that surprises me actually that she would like retell that story, because I feel like as conservative as she is and sort of as supportive of Trump as she has been, I do think that she's paving the way for her own political career and yeah. is yeah. and is more tactile with that kind of thing, because I think that she does appeal to conservative women and, you know, more suburban conservative women who frankly would find that a thing to say.
I would say that she would not only be doing herself a disservice to go as his running mate, because we saw how that worked out for his previous vice president, but I think that she is a Republican presidential front runner for eight
for sure
and yeah. beyond. And the best thing Sarah Huckabee Sanders could do is just run the shit out of the state she's in right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree with
whatever
that.
Whatever state that is.
You don't know what state that is?
I'm kidding.
What state is it?
You know,
this is where we cut to a poser. Yeah. It's that state. It's that
wah,
state.
Wah, wah. We need this like a sound effect.
Guys, Arkansas. Come on.
Arkansas.
She has Bill Clinton's job.
Forgot
more like Arkansas.
Anyway, just to wrap up on Gallego, he's someone that, you know, we've met and he, I think, has a very interesting plan to try to win voters in Arizona, specifically starting with the Latino vote, which I think is very natural for him. He's also a veteran, but it's just going to be, you know, it's going to be kind of, again, this race about what do people respond to more, someone like him or someone who's riding the coattails of Trump, who has really obviously taken hold of the Republican Party again. So
yeah,
we'll see. But that song, I mean, if you guys want to like actually.
It's a beautiful song. I just saved it to my
beautiful.
Playlist.
Beautiful. Might get a Grammy, 80, maybe.
It's literally called 81 Votes My Ass.
81 Million Votes My Ass.
81 Million Votes My Ass by Carrie Lake and the Truth Bombers.
I mean, this is like. You know, and this is like clown show politics. And to your
depressing.
Point about like,
this is like fully episode of Veep that yeah. should not actually yeah. be happening. So, you know, you can laugh it off, but then you have to actually think about what you're laughing at. And it's pretty fucked up.
All right. Who wants to go? You got something good?
Sure. Speaking of ass, that's a great, you know, segue. Tonight's airstrike sent a clear and divisive message that we will not tolerate terrorism. Despite repeated warnings from the international community, the Iran-backed Houthi rebels have continued their attacks, impeding the free flow of civilian commerce in the Red Sea. Mm. These strikes are necessary, responsive, proportionate, not escalatory. President Biden is right to act. The Houthi attack imperiled the global economy and increased the risk of a wider war. Minimizing the risk of regional conflict is of the utmost priority.
Steph Moulton.
Yes.
Wow.
What up, dog?
I mainly did it for Michael there.
Thank you.
Maybe before I just give some background on this topic, and I'm sure we've all heard about it a bit.
Mm-hmm.
It was very divided between Republicans and Democrats. Now, the far left progressives really shot at President Biden on this. Many people who used to be on our platform and still are ripped into Biden for this. Biden actually got, and then he got ripped on by the far right. But he actually got praise from a lot of Republicans for doing these attacks. So U.S. and Brit, do you guys know about this? You want me to give a little background?
Yeah,
give me a little backstory.
Just give a little back? Okay.
Honestly, I know the Houthis.
A little BG.
Remind people.
A little BG.
So I felt like this was actually done together, which is probably a good thing, but the U.S. and U.K., with the support of Canada, the Netherlands, and Bahrain, you know, got to get that Middle
really
East.
Really wild one, card. Thrown
as one, yeah, as one needs.
Just got to have one Middle East country in there. They bombed more than a dozen Houthi rebel sites across Yemen. And this was in retaliation against attacks on commercial ships in the Red Sea. Now, for over the last few months, this group has attacked more than 30 vessels.
Wow.
And which are tied to, they said, more than like 40 countries. So have been impacted by this raid. Now, for those of us who might know a little bit about the Houthi, they're backed by Iran. So they have come out, not Iran, Houthi has come out saying these attacks are retaliation for Israel's bombing and invasion of Gaza. So
wonderful.
This is, yeah, to me, this is really scary right now because this could be a third war that we're in. I'm saying Ukraine, Russia, Israel, Gaza, and now potentially Yemen. And once again, this is uniting, like these small little fights are uniting the rest of the, you know, other countries against, you know, the West, let's say.
And just to be clear, right, these Houthis are Houthi rebels in Yemen.
Yeah.
That Saudi Arabia is backing Yemen. Iran is backing the Houthi rebels in this sort of proxy war going on in Yemen.
Yeah. And there's been a civil war in Yemen for a very long time. Right. It's been a huge humanitarian crisis that has gained more attention since the invasion of Gaza, because people are sort of equating the humanitarian situation, even though the, you know, actual military situation is a little bit different, except both of these terrorist organizations are backed by Iran. I think that there's a couple of things. One is people may have noticed that the price of gas went up a little bit recently, which was...
I wouldn't know. I drive an electric vehicle.
Which was part of the effect of this, because a lot of oil is transported through the Red Sea. I remember, so Billy's dad was a military pilot, and he was saying that they used to fly out of the Red Sea all the time. That it's like a huge, I mean, it's in a massive place for a military, not military operation, but like for military ships.
Cargo.
To be, for like cargo traveling, like Anthony said, the global supply chain. So what was happening is that these commercial ships were being essentially attacked by pirates. You know, like you saw the movie Captain Phillips. It's like that, but more well organized in many ways. And it was escalating to a point where, yes, nobody was hurt, but they were still attacking these commercial ships. And so the U.S., or sort of I should say the Biden administration standpoint, is we weren't escalating. We were trying to prevent escalation from happening. And I think these people on the far left and on the far right are saying, you didn't have the right to do that because you weren't defending anything. And if there's any escalation, it has to technically have approval by Congress.
And by the way, to this point, like Biden is not the only president who has done this. Every president has done some attacks without congressional approval, which is why so many congressional leaders are up in arm. But Trump did it. Obama did this. But I just wanted to make a quick point to what you were saying, Hannah, about the humanitarian crisis. So this has been going, so the Houthis have been fighting like the Yemen government for over 20 years. So in 2004, so like Anna's saying they're basically pirates like raiding these ships. Yes, very true. But in 2014, they actually seized the capital of Yemen and they still like control that area today. But they're one of the poorest nations on earth. Since then, they've had about 400,000 deaths, and 60% of those deaths, they say, are because of hunger and disease. 4.5 million people have been displaced. You know, pretty wild.
It's,
I mean, it's honestly a look at what could happen in Gaza.
Well, I think, I think that just to kind of transition the conversation a little bit to sort of the American reaction, I think that is what people are seizing on, is this comparison between what's happening in Yemen and what could happen in Gaza. And I don't think that that's an incorrect comparison. But what is troubling to me is that I've seen on social media people who are very pro-Palestine and have been very outspoken about a ceasefire, all points
are now taking up the Houthi cause.
By the way, all that I very much respect are now sort of painting the Houthis as like these heroes.
Oh my God.
The reality is that the Houthis are not Yemeni government. They overthrew the Yemeni government. And like Anthony said, they've basically been in power. And similar to Hamas, they have no value of Yemen life. They are simply there to try to, you know, attain power, spread their version of Islam, and have some sort of global crisis that will allow them to remain in power. So I think that there's this sort of drive on social media. It's kind of the comparison of what happened where people were starting to equate, you know, being pro-Palestine with Black Lives Matter. And it's, you're taking all of these movements that are so distant from each other on a global scale, but are kind of rooted in the same idea of like
fighting the resistance kind of.
Yeah, a resistance. Yes. Right? And I think that resistance is important. Resistance is what the United States was founded on. It's a very important element of global politics, but not when it comes from terrorists.
Right.
So, yeah. You know, I think this idea that like the Houthis are somehow heroic or somehow doing something that is just, or that the U.S. stopping the Houthis is like interference in a way that is like equated with colonization or sort of oppression. I just think that that's incredibly dangerous rhetoric. And I feel like because of social media, it just spreads like wildfire and people do not understand what they're posting. And I'm not claiming to be an expert on this, but I feel that I have seen this stuff and there's something that's triggered in my mind of like, they're a terrorist organization. Like Iran is a bad country. Anyone who is funded by Iran is not good. That like that to me is just like a final, it has finality, that statement has finality to it. So there's a lot of technicalities on what you want to say is happening to the Yemeni people or what is happening to the Palestinian people. But you can't go as far as to say that like Hamas is doing something righteous or the Houthis by attacking these commercial ships are doing something righteous, because there's, it doesn't make sense in the present global politics. Yes, maybe there are past egregious things that have happened to minority groups in the Middle East, but this is not an appropriate response in our present world.
I would also just kind of quickly add, you know, very well said, by the way. You know, a lot of people listening might say, well, why does the goddamn Houthis have any impact on my life, right? As an American living in Venice Beach, California, or, you know, Kansas City, Kansas, go Chiefs. The answer is pretty simple, right? It's like, however isolated we want to imagine ourselves to be able to be, the global world that we live in does not allow for that. Technology no longer allows for that. And you said it at the start of this, which is gas prices have gone up, right? And so, and we saw that with the beginning of the Ukraine-Russia war, that, you know, all of these things are interconnected. And so when we look at, you know, our own domestic politics and we say, well, you know, F the president, they're not doing anything about inflation, they're not doing anything about gas prices, they're not doing anything about this, that, and the other. It's like, you know, all of this, it's all one connected amoeba. And it is A, important that we mind the global national security and the U.S. interest, but it also is important that we make sure that we are involved in setting prices, involved in writing global rules, and involved in, you know, this global energy and economic machine so that we are the benefactors of that.
I think that's our episode title, by the way, One Connected Amoeba.
One Connected Amoeba. All right. Well, speaking of that, should we move to a surprising one that I've got today? And it has to do with motherhood. All right, here we go. You're being forced to choose between your career and having a family. We're in way too much of a tech age for that even to be acceptable. What happens if I have to vote on war?
Oh, Anna Paulina Luna.
Golly. I mean, for real? How'd you know this?
Because I saw something about it.
I'm still trying to understand that tweet. I don't even know.
Well, I think you should give some context and it makes sense.
I should have. That was a poor setup on my part.
Okay.
So this was about her wanting to, or rather not being able to vote by proxy while she was home on bed rest after giving birth to her son, her new son.
Why is that relevant today?
But she was just on like maternity leave.
No, she was on.
He was on bed rest.
Bed rest, couldn't travel. Oh, wow.
Okay, what's the relevance to today, though? Why is she coming out talking about this?
Well, that's a great question. So Anna Paulina Luna, she's a 34-year-old conservative firebrand from Florida, okay? And, you know, Republicans have famously done away with proxy voting this Congress because they think that it's lazy, that it enables people to not show up for votes. And with such a razor-thin majority, they are requiring everybody to be there. So Anna Paulina Luna was pregnant. And what happened was she had intended to do what she calls a very granola home birth, her words, and all medical complications got in the way of that in the last minute. She had a very
surprise.
Yeah. She had a very, you know, arduous labor process. She was then, you know, hospitalized and on heavy medications and blood medicine. And so she couldn't travel. And so
She put herself in this condition.
Her Republican colleagues.
She decided to have a home birth.
We don't need to discuss the merits of home birth on the podcast.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Okay. So she put her life at risk. Cool.
So basically, this all happened when the House was voting to oust Speaker McCarthy, which she was a vocal proponent of, but doesn't, of course, say how she would have voted because she wasn't able to vote. And so she is introducing new legislation to basically create a law that helps new mothers who have just given birth, physically, not adopted mothers, to be able to vote by proxy after they have given birth. And she's even opened this up a little bit further and saying that we should take up the issue of maternity leave, which, by the way, congressional staffers can take, congresspeople cannot.
Crazy. I have so many thoughts on this. Yeah.
What's interesting here, just to set the stage for you, Anna, this is a far-right Republican woman who is only the 12th woman in Congress to give birth while in Congress, which is bonkers to begin with, but shows you that this is a male-dominated industry that has not created laws to catch up to modern times. Your thoughts?
It also is an older people-dominated industry. So One of the things that I think is most interesting about this is that not having any maternity leave, now, obviously, if you work at a company, there are legal, you know, there's regulation around this. But in a place like Congress, there is not.
Spoiler, they are the lawmakers.
They are the lawmakers, but they don't have the law. The law does not pertain to them.
Right.
But
incredible.
It is literally the most perfect example of how our government deters young women from running for office. Mm. And I think that I'm 33 years old. I'm in a point in my life where I'm like, I want to have kids. I don't want them right now.
We'll edit that out. She's 27, folks.
Yeah, you're past the age.
You start doing these calculations in your head of like, when do I have time to do this? Yeah. When do I have the money to do this? All this stuff. I'm sure you guys have friends that are going through that. And so I think that what I think is so interesting about this is I actually think that Anna Paulina Luna is the perfect person to be taking this up, because I think it takes a Republican. Democrats tend to be much pro-family leave. So I think it's perfect for a Republican woman to be taking this up and showing a way that Congress can come together, Republicans and Democrats, and advance this issue that ultimately will support not just women in general, but specifically women who want to run for higher office. And the Republicans know that they need to recruit more women. They know they need to recruit more young people. This is a way to do it. This is a way to show that if you are a 30-year-old woman and you want to run for Congress, you will have the option of having a child. And you don't have to put that on hold. You don't have to worry about the cost of freezing your eggs. That's something you don't have to worry about. And so that's my first thought. And the other thing that I wanted to say, though, is that I think this... The idea that
make a quick comment before on just what you were saying about she being the right person to take this up? I agree with you that, you know, this is somebody, given her conservative bona fides, that will theoretically move the needle on this. But I guess, what do you think of the just sort of really blatant hypocrisy here of, you know, she's somebody who has voted against child tax credits, somebody who has not been a vocal advocate for any of this until it happened to her. And then all of a sudden now it must take place.
I mean, this is the thing. politics is full of hypocrites.
Right.
So I, in my opinion, and this is just my individual opinion, I think you have to take the wins where you can get them. Yeah. I think to hold somebody's record against them and make it into this whole thing, which I'm sure Democrats will do.
Yeah.
If that endangers the passage of something like this, I think that it is showing the further dysfunction of our government. Because yeah.
Well, that's
I feel
a great point.
Because I think that like people switch their mind. I think that she should, by the way, should come out. I think she maybe did, but she should come out and say, I was wrong about proxy voting. Proxy voting does have uses in some capacity. I think that she should own up to that. She's not going to
She has not, but yeah.
She has not. I think she should, because I don't think that that is something that will hurt her politically.
Right.
She's not going to own up to not wanting the child tax credit. She's not going to own up to any of these other things. But I think that this is her, I think she should find a Democrat to work on this in a bipartisan way.
So she has support from Rashida Tlaib, who's not on our platform, who we discussed, and Matt Gaetz. There's like 20 lawmakers who are supporting this.
Good. So, but the other point that I wanted to make, and I have a lot of thoughts about this because I just think it's like so important.
We should have led with this.
Is that, well, we're close with it, end with a bang. Is that the fact that there is a caveat that this is not okay, that this is not possible for adoptive mothers, I think is very antithetical to what Republicans are trying to say about abortion.
I could not agree with you more.
And I think it's a huge mistake for her to not have to have that in there. I think that she actually should have said, and this goes for adoptive mothers, because we know that adoptive mothers are heroes. They give babies homes. And I'm personally not pro-life, but if I was pro-life, I would have been like, why the hell did you not?
Well, and this speaks to the lack of political savvy that I think a lot of these sort of firebrands and these like quickly vaulted into office figures. And by the way, I think that happens on both sides, but I think I'm seeing it much more on these sort of far right extremists that like Lauren Boebert. They don't have the political savvy to do that, right? Like your point, that is what a pro politician, that's how a pro handles it. And like, you know, I'm color me skeptical of just her track record so far. But like, yeah, it's not a track record that has impressed me from a political savvy or legislative passing point of view.
I also think that to then bring this idea of kind of the arduous nature of A, giving birth, which is an insane thing, and we diminish it in this country. And I will not have a home birth, but I think people have safe home births all the time. And I a little bit push back on what you said, Anthony. I think people should be able to give birth however the fuck they want.
I still can't get over it.
That's
Republican.
Wild.
The Republican doing it.
But it's not your it's not your choice. It's the woman's choice to decide how she wants to give birth.
Well,
but,
not in her state, it's not.
That's true. Yeah. But what I was going to say is I think that not only does it bring light to that, but I also think it shows that like being a new parent is really, really hard. And I feel like I hope that this can pass somehow with bipartisan support. And then I hope that Democrats take it and use it as an example to say, look what this Republican started. We're going to continue it. And we're going to show that members of Congress should be able to do proxy voting, not only if they are the birthing mother, but if they are a new father, if they are an adoptive mother, if they are if they are caring for a baby, they should be able to proxy vote, whether they are a man or a woman. And I think that that would be a very smart tactic for Democrats. I think, I don't know who's running against her. I know it's a very conservative district. I think it would be a very good thing for whoever her opponent in the next election is to talk about that. Because I think the fact that she has used her personal experience to come up with something that is very common sense and very good for electing younger leaders who are women, it seems like a no-brainer for me for Democrats to say, yeah, good job, Anna Paulina Luna, but we're going to go one step further and we're going to use your what you've kind of created and show how it should apply to everybody. Cheers.